Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we're talking about the last book on our 2023 book club list. This is a great book, and I know you're going to enjoy listening to our guest, the author, talk with us about it. Ron Rindo is the author of Breathing Lake Superior. That's the title. He is the author of three short story collections. He's a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. And as we talk with him today, I hope you'll join in. What would you like to know about the book? I hope you had a chance to read it. If you didn't, you can still join in. Questions about the book itself, or maybe about the writing process, or how you might improve your own writing? Well, I know we can talk about that because he teaches that to a lot of students and has done so. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Ron Rindo, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much, Larry. It is really a pleasure to be here with you.
I'm so glad you could come and be here in person. You know, I loved your book, and the book is, there are a lot of themes in this book. There's a family theme, there's a faith theme, there's depression, there's resilience. I think those are the ones that came the most quickly to mind. How did you land on this as the basis for your first novel?
Yeah, so you're right. It has a lot of different threads, and hopefully they are all woven together well by the time we get to the end. I think part of it, you know, with any kind of writing, it comes from things that you read, things that you've heard about, things that you've experienced, things that you wouldn't want to experience. Certainly the grief portion. Sometimes when I'm writing, what I end up writing is about something that I really would never want to happen, you know, to myself.
Yeah.
In a sort of a whispering past the graveyard kind of situation, and then for me, this book really sort of rose a bit out of my own teaching. I teach American literature as well, and to first year students, and I teach a whole unit on the Puritans, and so the idea of a character setting up a household in the wilderness to try to establish a sort of independent life and in reaction to some trauma is sort of where this originally came from. And so that's why you have all the epigraphs from the different Puritan writers. And then the way in which grief can cross over into faith, and the way faith can unfortunately cross over into fanaticism, is something that I've also been interested in. And I thought dramatizing that would be dramatic, right? And so that's what I was thinking about there with the father. He loses his youngest son, the guilt of the siblings and step-siblings who should have been watching him, and then their just brand new life in this new place. They move from this urban environment to this very, very rural environment without any running water, without any electricity, and they all have to adapt. The father, though, has that charismatic presence that sort of pulls them along until they finally realize he's gone a little too far and they can't pull him back.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, at this point it might be worth it to read, if you got the first paragraph perhaps of your book or so to read, which will help us even more.
Yes, absolutely. So this is the opening. It's in the voice of the stepson, whose name is John, who narrates the novel about his stepfather. Like many stories we cannot forget, this is a story about belief. Even before God spoke to him in the way he summoned Nat Turner in a Virginia cornfield, my stepdad Cal always told us that miracle was not a word to be used lightly, if at all. Like the word tragedy, it was not to be spoken or written unless it carried the precise meaning for which it had been intended. In all of human history, he said, few people had ever experienced anything truly miraculous or tragic. Modern culture had abused both words so often they had long been drained of meaning. But I know of no other words that fit our set of circumstances these past 14 months, if not tragic and miraculous. I don't know what our lives have become.
You know, That's a wonderful way to write, to start the to open the book. And you mentioned John is the, you wrote the story from the perspective of John, the son, in the book. And maybe first we should talk about the family itself.
Sure, sure. So the parents both lost spouses fairly early in their first marriages, and they married and each brought a child with them. So John is the stepson, and JJ, his stepsister, is in the family. And then the youngest child, David, is the only child who is the blood-related son of both parents. And so I like the stepson telling the story just because he can get closer to the father, and the father relies upon him, and he doesn't quite have that. You know, I'm a stepfather myself.
Yeah.
My wife and I have a blended family, and there's a different kind of relationship that you can have with your stepchildren, that perhaps a subtly less responsibility. You can be a little bit more supportive, a little bit more emotionally connected without worrying about, you know, correction and so forth. Mm. So John and Cal have that relationship. And Cal, he is an English professor, so language is important to him. And he's able to talk, and that's how later, when he moves toward his ecstatic faith, he becomes a preacher. He still has that connection to language and his ability to speak and motivate.
Yeah. And then JJ, of course, David, the young son, who
dies early in the book on the watch of the two children, two older children. So guilt is definitely part of that, what's dramatized here as well, because they were at they're at a pool, and they were supposed to be watching their youngest sibling. You know, when I was a boy, my youngest brother was about that age gap, and we had what was called Roger duty. Each of us children were responsible one day to keep an eye on him, and we did, and he's, you know, grown and healthy. But that is something that was always in the back of my mind. When you have the responsibility for a child, if something like this would happen, what would you do, right?
Yeah.
How would you cope with that guilt, you know?
Yeah, and so, and that's a part of this family dynamic that kind of manifests itself throughout the book in different ways. The family, you know, I like the way that you started the book talking about the family, because we get an idea of what that family was like. I'm glad we didn't start in northern Wisconsin.
Right, yeah. So it does, I think, start a little slow because in terms of the narrative, because I really did want to establish a sort of a baseline of what this family was like, right? And what the father was like. They love music. They're just pretty normal, as JJ says early on. Really nothing remarkable other than they love one another, and they're making it through, right? And they have some of the same kinds of problems that most families do, or blended families do. But I wanted at least people to see what things were like at one time.
Yeah.
Because they deteriorate over the course of the book until when you get to the end.
Typically, a typical family, a kind of, you know,
if
there is any such thing, a typical middle class family, you have fairly, you know, they're not super wealthy, but they're well enough off, and the kids, you know, they've got their phones, and they could do pretty much whatever they want,
right.
And a whole broad range of friends.
Right. Right. Sure. And so certainly for John and JJ, who are in high school, right, you're right, they have cell phones and they go out with their friends, you know, and they go to school. And so the change for them when the father moves the whole family to this dilapidated farmhouse in far northern Wisconsin, they lose all of that, right? They don't have any phones. They don't have any access to videos or the radio even. I mean, it really is a stark change for them as well.
Yeah, it definitely was that, and it's an event that kind of, I guess when we think about Cal, the father, he was, I guess they'd go to church a few times a year, in the beginning, but then he has an accident.
Right. So, yeah, so Cal is, as I said, charismatic, playful, really good with language, goes to church because his wife wants him to go and be there with the kids. Not someone who's particularly enthusiastic about that. And then when he loses his youngest son, and he has a really, really close relationship, right, to his youngest boy, and he will frequently, while he's watching TV at night, he unbuttons his shirt, the boy falls asleep on his lap, laying against his chest, and he'll bunt the boy right up inside of his shirt. So there's this really, really emotionally, you know, devastating loss that he experiences, and he doesn't know what to do with that. And for me, you know, whenever I hear even just about a family losing a young child, I think, how could I handle that? I don't know how I would, right? So it's a way of sort of imagining my way into that difficulty. And he struggles at first, and then he goes off the deep end ultimately, right? And crashes his car, right? He crashes his car and survives that. And the car is just in pieces. And the only piece that's large enough to hold him is the piece that he survived in. And so he sees this as a sign, and he begins to read his life through the eyes of a very ecstatically faithful person, and believes he's been saved for that for some reason. And he wants to start his life and his family's life over. And he dreams of this place in northern Wisconsin, and just drives up there, and he finds it. He finds this field.
Place that he dreamed about.
Yeah, he walks up on it, and he comes home, and the farmhouse is, there's windows missing, it's been abandoned, there's no heat, there's no electricity. There have been raccoons living under the sink, and there's pigeons living in the attic. But he sees the potential for that. He sees some possibility, and because he's such a charismatic person, he convinces his family, particularly his wife, and the children aren't so sure about this, but they ultimately, they go and they start over.
Rod Rindo is our guest today. He is the author of the book Breathing Lake Superior, a novel set primarily in northern Wisconsin, in Ashland County, as a matter of fact. And if you have questions or comments, if you've read the book, maybe you'll have a comment. I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us a question as well. Email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. A. Emily Ralph, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about our book club selection, the last of the year. We do four every year. We select four. And this is the fourth, and it is titled Breathing Lake Superior, a wonderful novel. And it's my pleasure to have the author with me in the studio today, Ron Rindo. He is a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh, has written three short story collections, and this is his first novel. And it's a dandy. So if you have a question or comment, either about the novel or maybe about writing, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Bob in Lewiston, Minnesota, we'll go to you. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm reading this book right now, and I keep getting the name of a guy by the name of Gordon McQuarrie in my head as I'm reading it. And I'm trying to figure out why.
Well, Gordon McQuarrie, well, go ahead.
I think he's an outdoor writer, isn't he, Gordon?
He was an outdoor writer, and he many of his stories, he was a wonderful writer. And many of his often hunting and fishing stories took place in Bayfield County.
Okay, so the place there, I love that brought to mind. So that means that the place that you're reading about in Gordon Macquarie and the place that I'm really interested in dramatizing here are the same place, right?
Yeah.
Sounds like.
Yeah. Bob, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you write well about the place. You know, I have a, with friends, we have a cabin in the town of Barnes in Bayfield County, and love that area, and probably not too far. You have a cabin as well.
Yes, and back in 1958, my grandmother bought 100-foot of frontage on Iron Lake for $2 a foot. her brother worked for the REA, and they were running lines, and he told her, you know, there's some land out for sale on this lake, and he was going to buy some frontage, and his boss was going to buy some frontage, but he didn't want to be next to his boss. So he asked his sister if she'd be willing to buy some frontage, and she did. And so we've had that in our family since 1958, so even before I was born. Yeah, so I love the northern half of the state. Whenever I get north of Highway 77, I just can breathe differently, right? It's just so beautiful, the Shawquamagon Nicolet National Forest. We go to Lake Superior a lot. And so I always tell my students, you know, in terms of that place is so crucial, right, to identity. The phrase I use is where you are is who you are. And there's something rugged and beautiful and harsh about northern Wisconsin that I really wanted to capture in this book. The winter, particularly, is really rough on them. When they're up there, can you imagine being in a small house with no central heat? They're trying to keep the place heated with a single wood stove in the downstairs, relying on you know, the heat rising to get to the upstairs. And it's 5-6 months of the year, you know, below zero every morning. It's pretty rough. So, but I love northern Wisconsin, and I love the Big Lake. We go across the bay from Bayfield to Madeline Island every summer and take our bikes and bike around the island. There's something just so rugged and beautiful about that place, and I wanted to capture that.
You do a nice job of capturing it. For me, it's always when you get to the lake. I mean, it's like a different experience when you see and kind of smell the lake.
Right, yeah. So one time we were up there, it was like 90 degrees in Iron River, and we drove up to the lake, and it was like 65, right, when the wind is from a certain direction. And so in this book, the lake is nearby, and they can smell it, and they can feel its weather, but they don't actually ever visit it until the journey they take down the river. Near the end, the brother and the sister. I don't want to talk too much about what happens at the end, but they do take a journey down the Cranberry River, and that's an actual river. It flows into Lake Superior in Herbster. It's a place where we've gone to gather sea glass many, many summers. And that's sort of based that journey. My cousin who lives in Moqua, 1 year, many, many years ago, he took his children, a few nieces and nephews, they all piled in a boat, and they tried to float down Fish Creek into Lake Superior. And they brought lunches and some water. And of course, there were about a million trees in the way. They had to keep getting out, pulling it out. And they didn't get out. I think it was midnight when they had no cell reception. I mean, it was, and so that there is a journey like that late in the book where they have to take this long trip to try to get out on the lake. But they do make it, and they get out on the water.
Yeah, they make it in the rowboat, which is, I like the cover. After I looked at the cover and I thought, well, it doesn't look like Lake Superior.
Right. But then, exactly.
Beforehand, but until then I finished the book, I looked back at the cover and I thought, man, that's perfect.
It makes perfect sense. Yeah, that's a really important scene.
Well, there's a lot more we can talk about here. And you do a really nice job of describing the pain of, and JJ was really an interesting, the daughter who is actually Cal's
biological daughter, correct.
Biological daughter.
Right. Yeah, so each child has a slightly different reaction to what's going on. And JJ, because I think he's her biological father, and because she's been with him her whole life and she knows him really well, she is most repulsed by his drift toward this ecstatic faith and this new way of being. And so she fights it harder. And because of that, I think emotionally, it's more difficult for her. But she and her brother, her stepbrother, right, they get closer, which often happens when a tragedy like this happens and where they're sort of trying to figure out how to navigate their way with parents who aren't fully engaged with them because of their own grief. And so her relationship with John develops over time, but she also falls into a deeper and deeper depression as a result of this, and her guilt really drives that, I think. John isn't the most, I think, interesting character other than Cal. There's a line in a, I think it's a Hawthorne letter, he's writing about Melville, and he says, you know, he can neither be, he neither believes in God, nor can he be uncomfortable in his disbelief. And John is kind of that character. He sees his father doing these things, and his stepfather, and he wants to believe, right? He deeply wants to believe. And ultimately, and I can talk about this since it says it on the back of the book, when Cal decides that he might actually have been imbued with these powers, he decides he can perhaps raise their young son from the dead. And John wants to believe that can happen, right? And so that's why he just stays close to Cal and he listens and he hopes, right? And of course, anytime something really terrible happens, you wish you could reverse time, right? You wish you could go back and make it, undo it. And so there is that element of magical thinking here where Cal and John really want that to happen. But of course, it can't happen.
It can't happen. And as they sort of get their act together, a lot of bad things happen. I almost knew what was going to happen with a barn, for example, because I came from a farm family.
So you know not to put hay up wet.
I know not to put hay up wet. There were, you know, these tragedies that had to be overcome, and Cal is making these kind of demands on the family, and they resist it, but they go along with it. I mean, they...
Right. Yeah, the mom, she loves her husband, right? And she wants him back, and she's willing to wait and hope. And for a while, he kind of wins her over, right? She sees it's beautiful. They plant a garden. The barn does burn down, right? And that's horrible. That happened. My uncle had a beef ranch down in southern Illinois, and he put his hay up wet and burned his barn down. I mean, that's... But they can get through that, and they do. And then what happens with Cal, though, is in a dream again, he dreams and believes that he's supposed to start preaching. And this comes after they have this interaction with these militia people in northern Michigan. And he stands up for African Americans and tries to sort of push back against some of that hard right vitriol that he's been hearing. And then he believes he's supposed to start preaching, so he builds this log church in a hexagonal structure. Says he dreamed about it. Says he learned it from bees, and he starts to preach in this little chapel on their land, and people start to come. And what happens is some of the elderly, a group of people come down from Herbster, and they start to believe that he can, by laying his hands on them, he can heal them. And John wants to believe that too, right? And they start giving the family money. They give the family a lot of money ultimately. And that's what starts to bring the law into the situation and into the family because they believe there might be some fraud involved. And Cal is innocent of that. He really is not sure if he can heal these people or not. He doesn't really think he can, but they think he can, and they almost convince him. And that, so that's what starts to make him think maybe he can actually do this.
Yeah. Well, the guy asks the first person, the black gentleman, asked him to put Cal to put his hands on his knees because he couldn't walk without a cane, I think it
right,
was.
Right.
But he walks out.
He walks out. He puts the cane up in the rafters, right? And then his partner, Agnes, she is going blind, macular degeneration, and he touches her eyes, and she starts driving again, and she believes that she can see. Mm-hmm. So there's evidence enough for these folks to start thinking that this is happening. And as that word spreads, of course, people start coming from all over. People start coming mm-hmm. from far away, driving from Nebraska and Kansas and so forth, mm-hmm. with children in wheelchairs. And it becomes this really large and complicated thing that ultimately Cal turns away from, because he just can't handle that kind of pressure, and that they have this little chapel that can fit 20 mm-hmm. people inside of it, and suddenly there are hundreds of people showing up on Sundays to try to come.
Yeah. Tony in Highland, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Tony. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. My first question is this the same Ron Rindo who is a graduate of Muskego High School?
Yes, I graduated from Muskego High School. Who is this?
Well, hello. This is Tony Wood calling. I don't know if you're...
Hi. Hi, Tony. Wow.
Good old days.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
A very long time. But I wanted to know, because I'm a playwright now, a screenwriter, I wanted to know what was the point in your career, or at least in your life, where you realize, because everybody's got a story in their head, but you cross a line into putting it down on paper and thinking that you need to record the stories, because writing is so hard for people. When did you find that point where you knew that those stories that were in your head, or the things that you were thinking, the notes that you were taking, you could actually get down and tell that story, put pen to paper?
Sure. Yeah, that's a really good question. And in a lot of ways, I'm really, really fortunate, right, and blessed in my life. I knew I wanted to do this since I was a boy, since I started to read, actually. I think that's true for a lot of writers. You get a great pleasure from reading, right? It just moves you so much. And the transition from being a reader to being a writer is actually a very short one, right? Because you get a lot of the same kind of pleasures, right? It expands the boundaries of your world. You get to be other people. You escape the sort of confines of your own identity, right? So you literally get to try on all of these other lives. And I just found that really intoxicating from the time I was a young boy. So I was writing stories in notebooks when I was a kid, right after I started to write. Learn to write and read. And then I think in college, you know, I sort of fell away from that a little bit. But then when I went to graduate school again, I did a PhD in American literature. But at the same time I was writing my dissertation, I was writing my first collection of short stories. It was just something that I just wanted to keep doing. And then I was fortunate enough to get a job that, you know, a part of my job actually is to write and publish work. So I mean, as I said, I feel so fortunate that I've been able to do what I love and what I've wanted to do my whole life.
Tony, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to George in Wanakee. George, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm very interested in this storyline, and I'm curious to know from the writer how it is that he approaches the theme of grief. And what I'm asking here is, as a writer, are you able to simply conjure up elements of what you imagine grief to be? Or as a writer, are you drawing from personal experiences?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I have, to this point, lived a pretty charmed life. I've not had to suffer the degree of grief that the father in this book suffers when he loses his youngest child. That said, right, I think I am often overwhelmed by the grief of others, right, when you see what other people go through. And so I don't know if it's that far really to imagine myself into that situation, right? That's sort of what I do here, is I imagine my way into this and really into every one of the characters, you know, and how they interact with one another, but also how they react both in the short term and the long term to this just absolutely debilitating grief that they're struck down by. I personally have not endured it, and it's mostly imagined.
Well, you do a wonderful, that period right after the death, and your description of that seemed, you do a wonderful job with that.
Thank you. Yeah, I just, you know, think about what you would do, how you just go back home, right? You say goodbye. The child in the morning is alive, and in the evening is no longer with you. How do you just go home and resume your own life, right? How do you just go back to what you were? I find people who are able to endure that to be just miraculous, really. And so, again, I said this really early on, you know, I sometimes write about things I cannot imagine enduring myself. And this is certainly one of those times, yeah.
I can tell you that I have a daughter who would have been 22 years old on April 2nd this past year. I don't talk about it much.
No, I can understand, of course.
But as I read your writing, I thought, man, you captured so well.
I'm so sorry, Larry. I can see how that would just be, it stays with you. It never leaves you, right?
Yeah. George, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. You know, that chapel was really interesting to me. And there's another aspect to it that I've, you know, later there's an engineer, I think, or architect who comes and to see it because it's never been, he said, there's no building like it exists in the world.
Right. Yeah, he comes to take pictures and to take measurements and look at it because it's been in the news. This is we haven't really talked about what happens at the end, but it gets really dramatic. And so after all of the dust clears and people start coming just to check it out, he comes and looks at this hexagonal chapel built of logs and built without any construction equipment.
You do a nice job of, now that I'm thinking of it, I don't know if you could pull that out of your book, but there is a place where you talk about the actual construction.
Oh, yeah. Maybe after a break I could find that and read that, sure. Yeah, so the father just dreams of this, right? And it puts it together, right? And uses levers and ropes and pulleys and constructs this cathedral out of logs. And then at the end, when the son, John, the stepson, is being questioned by this architect about how it happened, he just says he dreamed it, and he learned from bees, is what he says, right?
Yeah.
The triangle is, right, in construction, the triangle is the strength, right? That's the strong engineered component of any structure. And so two triangles gives you that hexagon that was what you get in a beehive. So, I mean, I just made that up. I don't know if it's actually true. I don't know how such a building would stand.
You know what? Let's take a break and we'll let you
I'll find it.
You'll find it. Our guest today, Ron Rindo. He authored the novel Breathing Lake Superior. It's our books club selection. Great to have him with us. And you can join in too. The number to call 800-642-1234. You can email to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Ron Rindo, who is the author of Breathing Lake Superior. It's our final book club selection for the year, and it is a dandy book. It's fun to have him with us. If you have a question or comment, maybe about the book or about writing, hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Just before we broke, we were talking about the chapel that in the book that Cal builds and the fact that maybe later an engineer comes and says he's another building like this doesn't exist in the world. And you've found
the
section about how it was built.
Right. So this is just after their barn burns down, and he wakes up and he says, you know, I'm going to build this cathedral. And he says, God had given the bees an instinct to build hexagonal honeycombs. And he says, if the Egyptians could build pyramids without bulldozer cranes, we could certainly erect a hexagonal law cathedral. His wife is like, what are you talking about? Right? Why? And so he enlists the help of John, and they start felling trees, and then they start building. And so this is the section where this happens. In the beginning, Cal's cathedral looked like a pile of logs someone had dropped from the sky. Trees stripped of their branches, crossed in every direction, like a forest decimated by a tornado. Logs angled toward the center in some places, toward the outside in others. When Mother and JJ came out to watch, JJ compared it to the picture of a web spun by spiders on LSD, which he'd seen in a psychology textbook. Cal smiled at her. I can see how you'd think that, he said, but wait until we get the walls up, then it will all come together. We arranged the first layer of shorter logs into an interconnected hexagon on the ground to see how they fit together, then began joining them to one another with wooden pegs as we stacked them along the beams we'd previously constructed. We leveled the first layer carefully, digging beneath those that were too high, stacking large flat rocks beneath those that needed to be raised. As each new layer of logs was stacked upon the one beneath it, I could begin to see the shape of the building. Seen from the air, it would look almost as if it were a single cell of a honeycomb, or a kind of crown, with other logs radiating from it like shafts of light. But the walls also bulged outward at the bottom and then inward at the top, where they would meet at the roof in a six-sided spire. Because of the unusual structure, the building would require no columns inside for support, but some of the rafters would emerge through the walls outside and would angle into the ground like the flying buttresses of an old stone cathedral. So that's how it gets built, right?
And you just thought that up.
Yeah, I did. I did. You know, I was thinking of Notre Dame in Paris, sort of a log version, a smaller log version, kind of. And so they do. They get it built, and they use hay bales for seats and put an old stove in there to heat it, and Cal starts to preach.
Yeah. You know, the business about not having any idea. I mean, he wasn't a builder or an architect or anything, so it had to come from somewhere.
Right.
And he, you know, he says it comes from God.
Yeah, he does. He believes that. And so, you know, I'm really interested in that, right? And interested in people whose faith is so powerful, right? And who begin to move toward sort of miracle, right? Miraculous kind of thinking. And as I said, John gets kind of pulled along. JJ and the mother, not so much. The mother retains, you know, sort of her skepticism pretty much all the way through. But she supports her husband, tries to get him back, ultimately. She wants to try to bring him back. But then, you know, once the sheriff comes around and starts accusing him of fraud, he starts getting angry. And then little by little, his interactions with the law get more hostile, which leads toward the sort of the end. There is a figure that lives down the road who's also a member of a militia and who supplies him with weaponry that is well beyond what the normal person would be allowed to carry. And so as we move toward religious fanaticism, ultimately, as we see right now what's going on in Israel, it gets violent and horribly violent, unfortunately.
You know, the way you treat faith and religion, I admired that a lot, because there would be ways to have treated Cal and treated the storyline in almost polar opposite directions.
Sure. Sure.
Than what you treated it. And so you did, I think, a really nice job of treating that whole process very evenly.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot. I mean, that's what I'm hoping for, right? In a novel, right, in art, you really don't want to be rhetorical, right? I'm not trying to make an argument. I'm just trying to show how people live through complex problems. And how faith what kind of role faith can play, right? Both for good and for ill, really. So I want people to see Cal and to see his profound faith as you know, a source of his strength, but also it becomes and it can cross over, right, into something that is not, I think, an accurate representation of what faith ought to be, probably.
Linda emailed us. She was an English writing major in college. She loved the writing process in college, and now many years later, she wants to write again. Do you have a suggestion as to how to begin?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different ways to go, right? But in terms of, if you want to write a book, right, if you just do a page a day after a year, you've got, you know, 365 pages. So writing is difficult. That's true for everybody. Almost everyone I know, even, you know, writers who've published a lot, as soon as you have to sit down to write, suddenly there's laundry that needs to be done and there's shopping that you could get done. The grass needs mowing. So I think the key is to get into a disciplined frame of mind where you're writing at the same time every day or every other day or every third day. I write in the mornings now because it's when I'm freshest and when I can be most productive. Not every day because I teach often, but on the days that I don't teach, I always try to carve out a little time in the morning, and then I always try to have one full day where I can start writing at about 8 and write until about 3 or 4 o'clock. So I would advise anyone who wants to start writing, right, that fluency will come with practice. It's just like learning to play the piano or learning anything. You only get better at it, and you only can do it regularly if you start, right? And
yeah. So, have some idea.
Yeah, in terms of what to write about, you know, things that you're passionate about. My advice to students is always write the kind of story that you like to read. And so if you like to read high fantasy, then write some high fantasy. If you're reading... I like to read literature, write literary texts, then write literary fiction. You could write your memoir if you have had an interesting life. You can start telling stories from your own life, you know, life stories. In terms of the subject matter, right, I think the best advice, though, is just to write what you'd like to read. So if you read memoirs, maybe that's what you should be writing, your own memoir. If you like reading science fiction, right, you're aware of the structures and language in science fiction, maybe that's where you should be.
I think you're right. I think I've asked many authors that question over time, and that's a pretty close variation on what I get from a lot of people.
That's what I do. I mean, I write the kind of story that I want to read.
And some authors want to have a complete outline and write from that, and others...
Sure. Yeah, so for a novel, now I was primarily a short story writer for a good portion of my career because it fit better with my teaching schedule and so forth. A novel takes so much more concentration to just keep everything together. The metaphor that I use for writing a novel, it's not my own. I don't remember who said it first, but it's like driving a car at night in the dark, right? Your headlights only shine so far forward, so you only know how much that far, you know, but as you drive, you're going further and further. Ultimately, with a novel, you have to then go back and try to show how everything pieces together. It's a different process altogether than writing a short story. And I've never written memoir. I've written some nonfiction essays, but never a full book-length memoir. So my life isn't all that interesting.
it sounds pretty interesting to me. Lou in Duluth, Minnesota, we'll go to you. Hi, Lou.
Oh, we lost Lou. I love Duluth too.
Darn, I'm sorry we lost Lou. I'm sorry we lost her. Well, yeah, I've not written a novel. I've edited my writing has been of an academic nature.
Okay. Yeah.
So writing about research, right. And
writing is difficult no matter what genre you're working in, right? It's a really slow, really inefficient process. And, you know, when we have a drive-through culture right now where we expect instant instant, you know, life, and we have Twitter, and everything's so fast, and writing is slow, and it's monotonous, and writing well is just really difficult and inefficient. But for people who write, right, it's as I said, the same pleasure from reading. And so if you're a reader, most people are at some point, right, they feel as if they want to write, right?
Yeah.
It gives you the same intensity, I guess, as a good book, writing one.
Well, I've got the sort of the bare bones of an idea of my own, which I may at some point yet do. Well, we've got Lou in Duluth, Minnesota back, so let's go there. Hi, Lou.
Hey, good afternoon. It happens with phones, right? Technology.
For sure.
Just wondering if you could touch on where the process where you sit down is not just easy enough to just sit down and start writing. Non-writers don't quite understand that there's a process that happens when you sit down with your pen and paper, that it takes a minute for you to get back into that flow. And that's why you can't just sit down and say, write for, you know, 15, 20 minutes. There's a whole process, a mental gymnastics, if you will, that that happens. And if he could talk, you know, a little bit on that. I've got a couple movie ideas and a couple of books that have been started. My ideas always come with what if.
Sure.
That's usually a good starting point. Well, what if, you know, and then you go from there.
Yeah, you sound like a writer, Lou. You're talking about that. You're absolutely right, right? What happens eventually, and I don't want to make it too mysterious or anything, but you reach a certain level of concentration, right? I describe it metaphorically. It's similar to when you're at the movie theater and you're watching a film, and it's a film that you've just really, really loved. And you get up and you walk outside, and you can't find your car, and you don't know where you are. That level of immersion in that alternative world is so deep and so intense that it takes a while to get away from it again and to move back into the regular world. When writing is going well, it's the same experience, right? So there's this intensive concentration in that dramatic moment on the page. And that becomes something that you go after. And when you're writing well, you can also refer to that as fluency, I think, right? When you're writing well, you can reach that level of concentration earlier and earlier, I think. And again, it only comes with practice. There's a writer, Russell Banks, he talks about this. This is the other thing that concentration gives you. He says, and I find this so true, that in the process itself, like when I'm actually writing, I'm smarter than I really am, and I'm able to make connections across disparate things, which is where creativity lies, right? I'm far more sensitive to other people and their lives than I am at any other time in my life. So there is this sort of mystical thing that happens when you're writing that enables you to be more empathetic and to make greater connections and to explore more deeply the lives of people radically unlike your own life, that's part of the great, great pleasure in being a writer. But the more you write, though, the more regular you write, the more you are able to enter that level of concentration, I think.
Yeah, that's very well said. Lou, I'm glad you called. Thank you so much for visiting with us today. You know, there's the story builds, which we're not going to go into the terrible kind of thing that happens near the end. But one thing I was really glad about was the end.
Yes.
In the end, I felt so much better. You get so invested in the family and in the people.
Right. Right. Yeah, you know, I know the feeling you're talking about because it happens to me all the time when you're watching a TV show or a film or you're reading a book. Like, you get this knot in your stomach because you don't want certain things to happen, right? You want those kids to survive. They've gone through so much and you don't want them to suffer anymore. So there has to be this combination, I think, this blend of sort of a realistic, you know, sort of resolution of the conflict. But then, right, something really sort of not quite miraculous, but it's somewhat miraculous, occurs at the end. And the family is able to, the ones who are left, are able to move forward, right? And the bodies and, you know, the way in which something tangible like hope and memory become this tangible sort of metaphor, Lake Superior, I should say, becomes this metaphor for those things, putting hope and memory together and breathing it, right, as a way of trying to move forward and holding the best of something in memory and being able to move forward in that way. So that's how the lake kind of pulls everything together. And I love that you saw that.
Oh, I felt really good at the end about the family and in so many ways. And Ron, I hope, here we are coming up to the end, I hope that it's done well.
Yes, it's doing really well. I'm getting lots of, publishing nowadays, it's so much about social media and Goodreads and all of that, and all of that has been going really, really well. And I so appreciate you having me on to talk about this. I really, really enjoyed speaking with you. I've listened to you for years, and to be sitting here talking with you has just been just a fabulous experience. So I thank you for that, Larry.
It's been my pleasure, Ron. Thank you so much. Ron Rindo, our guest, his book, I hope you have a chance to read it. It's titled Breathing Lake Superior. And you know what? After our break, we're going to take a talk with someone else about grief and dealing with grief. That next, after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.